The reading is in Luke chapter 12, starting at verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of one's possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, So, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God.'"
John Davison Rockefeller died in 1937, his personal net worth, $340 billion in today's money. He's widely accepted as being the richest person in the modern era who has ever lived. And his success was due to the Standard Oil Company, a company that he founded. Many of the oil companies that we know today, like BP and Exxon, they had their origin in the Standard Oil Company. He was once asked advice on how to get rich, and he said very simply three things: go to work early, secondly, stay at work late, thirdly, find oil. Well, I've been in the city for 30 years, and I remain pretty optimistic about being able to do most things, but I concluded my chances of finding oil pretty slim. So I went to ChatGPT and asked for advice. I wrote this question: what would be the best way for a Church of England minister to make £1 million in his spare time, note the spare time, in his spare time in the City of London in 2023? Well, the internet's most accessible artificial intelligence thought for about 4 seconds and then gave a very carefully crafted response. I quote exactly: "As I am AI, I must advise that any financial advice provided is purely educational in nature and should not be construed as professional financial advice. That being said," this is an exact quote, "as a general response to your question, it is not appropriate or ethical for a Church of England minister to use their position to make a large amount of money in the City of London." Which means I just got told off by AI. It's hard sometimes, though, isn't it, not to be distracted with money, with wealth, the generation of cash. In the passage that we have today, Jesus explains two different approaches. I put it on the handout there, two ways to live, we might say. And what you might find interesting, surprising, there are lots of surprises in the text today, what you might find surprising is that both the ways he outlines are about being rich. You'll see the summary in the last verse that we just heard read, verse 21. "So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." First, Jesus outlines the self-centered life, the one who lays up treasure for himself. The person that Jesus uses to capture this way of life is the star of the parable, the rich fool. No prizes for guessing what Jesus thinks of that character. The life the rich fool lives might sound quite extreme, but again, another surprise is just how normal the life that's described as foolish would look today. It would just look very normal, especially in the context in which we are. And secondly, Jesus outlines the core characteristics of the alternative life, the one who is rich toward God. And we'll think more about what that looks like as well in due course. Let me just say a few things about money and wealth as we start. I think most of us, most of the time, assume that money and personal wealth is a strictly private matter. It's interesting that the Bible doesn't really speak about money and wealth and cash in those sort of terms. It's often much more open or challenging than we are prepared or comfortable to really admit. But also, it should be pointed out, the Bible does not condemn wealth. And it's really important that we understand that as Christians today. The Bible does not condemn rich people for being rich. In fact, the Bible is full of lots of super good rich guys and girls in the Bible. King Solomon, he had wealth that would have made J.D. Rockefeller look like a pretty small man, actually. And we mustn't forget the Magi. They were the wise men from the East. Undoubtedly, if you were with us at Christmas, I mean, we concluded then, didn't we, that they were the original crazy rich Asians. The Bible is not against rich people at all. And so the application of the passages on cash are always thought-provoking. And they apply to us all, whether we've discovered oil or not. So it's worth thinking carefully about the lessons today. So first, the self-centered life. It's the first point on the handout there, the self-centered life. Remember, Jesus' fame has drawn huge crowds. We saw last week, people were trampling over one another. It's a sort of Glastonbury-type sort of experience. People were desperate to hear what Jesus had to say. And he was warning them last week, warning them about the poisonous, the contagious nature of the establishment's words and teaching, the Pharisees, the scribes of Jesus' day. We thought about that last week. And then suddenly, he finishes that, and then suddenly, 12 verse 13, look at where we started our passage today. Someone in the crowd said to him, to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." It seems a little off subject, doesn't it? It's like the words of Jesus have had no impression on this guy at all. All he can think about, my inheritance, my inheritance. It's been famously said, when there's inheritance, 99% of people become wolves. Who knows what's going on in this guy's head? The person could only think about his cash. And he was convinced that he was being cheated. He saw Jesus as reasonable, and hence, you know, the response that Jesus gives. Verse 14, Jesus said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" You see, Jesus is not interested in becoming a local magistrate in this family dispute. But it does perfectly set up the thing that Jesus does want to do here. He wants to expose the danger of a self-centered life. And in that sense, it does follow on beautifully, and not surprisingly, exactly what's happened before. You see, the warning to beware of the hypocrisy of the establishments develop into warnings to beware of the danger of materialism. And that's the progress in terms of the argument. And so, turning to the wider crowd, well, Jesus starts by exposing covetousness. And so you'll see the subpoint there, coveting. Coveting lots of stuff. Verse 15. And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness." The man wants more of what he hasn't got. That is what coveting is, wanting something that you haven't got. And I guess all of us can relate to that, can't we? We all want more of what we haven't got at various times in our lives. Sometimes it's going to be driven by greed. Sometimes it could just be driven by a desire to provide a better life for ourselves, for those that we love around us. I mean, after all, we are overwhelmed, aren't we, by the advertisers all the time, being informed and persuaded and reminded about what we don't have, what we could have, what we should have. Many years ago, Plato wrote, "The desire of man is like a sieve or a pierced vessel, which he ever tries to and can never fill." More recently, Mark Twain, "Civilization is a limitless multiplication of unnecessary necessities." And I think this challenge that Jesus makes strikes closer to our hearts than we like to admit. Jesus goes on to show us why coveting is so dangerous. Coveting is so dangerous because you might actually get what you want. And to do this, Jesus shows us the super rich guy that we've made reference to already. He functions as a hypothetical character. He's the star of the parable and exposes the true danger of coveting. And you'll see the second bullet point there. Getting lots of stuff. Verse 16. And he told them a parable saying, the land of a rich man produced plentifully, and he thought to himself, what shall I do, for I have nowhere to store my crops? And he said, I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. So, is this thoughtful, diligent planning and good stewardship? Well, at this stage, it could be construed that way, but look at verse 19. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. You see, he doesn't want barns to store his goods so that he can be a good steward. He wants barns so that he can store his goods to serve himself. In the end, this man has one key priority, himself. He desperately wants self-time, me time, we call it. Well, there are a few details in the text which really bring this to life. Look at verse 17 in the parable. It's really interesting. I mean, Jesus is telling this parable, but who becomes the main narrator of the parable? The guy in the parable. He assumes control, which of course makes the point sort of in a wonderful way within the story. The man takes over as the narrator, a clear indicator of increasing autonomy. And then look at the end of verse 17. Whose crops? My crops. Verse 18, the theme continues. My barns, my grain, my goods. The man lives for one purpose, to serve himself. End of verse 19 again. You have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry. There's something deeply appealing about the easygoing life. The sort of idea of just stepping to one side of the rat race and allowing things to just be comfortable. It's so appealing, isn't it? I mean, those lines, relax, eat, drink, and be merry. I doubt there's a single one of us who doesn't just think, yeah, that sounds good. Hard work for a season, careful management of resources, 5-star, first class, room serviced, luxury life that just goes on. I've definitely shared this story before, but it seems all the more relevant now given my age, because in one of my first jobs, as I say, I've been working in the city for quite some time before as a church minister, about 10 years or so, and in my first job, we were all encouraged to sit down with financial advisors, and we were told, well, the first question we were asked, when do you want to retire? Let me just say, had I stayed in that career, had I followed the advice that was given, had I sort of retired at the age that I suggested I wanted to, I would have been retired for 3 years by now. And that hit me quite hard as I was preparing this again. But here's the shock. And I think this is where the punch of the parable hits home. You'll see the third subpoint. What happens then? Verse 20. God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? Our man has overlooked one important detail. His riches are ultimately worthless. And it's really important to understand, a fool in the Bible is not a reference to somebody's mental ability. It's rather their spiritual discernment. And that becomes obvious with the reference to the soul. Verse 19 alerts us to the problem. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Here are the words of a fool. How can stuff like money, which is material, be useful to a soul, which is spiritual? One of the major influences in C.S. Lewis's life was George MacDonald. George MacDonald was quite a character. He was his sort of tutor as C.S. Lewis grew up, and MacDonald appears sometimes with that name in various sort of books that Lewis has written as one of the characters, because he had such a big influence. And he famously said, MacDonald, this is not Lewis, he famously said, you do not have a soul. You are a soul, and you have a body. Of course, very few people in this world around us understand that. But in the real world, one day God decides when our time is up. Verse 20, but God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required of you. One commentary puts it like this, the soul which had hoped for ease is now called to attention. And there's something sort of horribly ironic about verse 20. Look at the end. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? You see, no matter how big your coffin is, I had a big friend, to put it bluntly, who said to me, I'm going to have a big coffin, and I'm definitely putting my flat screen TV in that. But it doesn't make any, it's ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, look at the grave of Tutankhamun. We all sort of studied that in primary school, didn't we? The incredible treasures that he had. Look, where is he now? Treasures are dispersed amongst museums in the world. No matter how big your coffin, you can't take it with you. And so Jesus spells out the alternative, not the self-centered life, but the God-centered life. And you'll see two sub-points there as well. Be on your guard and rich toward God. Be on your guard. Verse 15. And he said to them, take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. You see, the idea of defining possessions in our lives as something that we've achieved, it misses the whole point, doesn't it? Here's another useful thing I found in one of the commentaries I thought it was worth quoting. Few people think of the danger of getting rich. Most think they become great, just in proportion as they gather wealth. And yet, never was there a more fatal error. A man is really measured by what he is, not by what he has. And it goes on, we may find a shriveled soul in the midst of a great fortune and a noble soul in the barest poverty. A man's real life is what would be left of him if everything else were stripped away. His real worth is his character. As it appears in God's sight, we may make a great mistake if our goal in life is simply to gather more worldly trinkets than our neighbor. The stuff we have, it will never satisfy, and it was never meant to. Humanity, of course, was created for something much greater than the material, for a relationship with God, the God who made us, created us to relate to him. That's our primary eternal purpose. And so our priority now needs to be centered around making much of that rather than the alternative that's outlaid here. See, to covet is to desire other things that will replace that desire, that primary reason that we were made. To chase money and possessions is to replace the creator with the created. It's an act of rebellion against God. It's basically the definition of sin, the ultimate reversal. And Jesus says, we need to be on our guard. We need to take care and be on our guard. I don't know much about the sort of the function of a guard, but it's not too hard to imagine, is it? A guard is stationed on the edge of a camp to protect the camp, to warn of imminent danger. And the point that Jesus is making here is don't think that this enemy is a pushover. It has a much more powerful effect than we often give it credit for. Be ready to take action, says Jesus. The real fight is against money. It's a true spiritual battle. And instead, this is where we land, be rich toward God. Verse 20. God said to him, fool, this night your soul is required, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. The fool stores up treasure for himself. By contrast, the person who is rich toward God, and I thought a lot about what that could mean. I think a sort of a quick reading, and we may well conclude that the obvious way to be rich toward God is to sort of, instead of having lots of sort of treasure and cash yourself, is just to give it all to the poor. That's the sort of thing certainly most people who are looking in on Christianity think that Christians are all about, giving to the poor. But Jesus is way more nuanced than that, way more nuanced than some sort of prosperity gathering in a church which tells everyone to empty their pockets. Look at the phrase again, last three words of the passage, rich toward God. The real sort of change in my thinking, my understanding, came when I sort of thought about the alternative. Rich toward God, rich toward self, must be the opposite of that. Rich toward God, rich toward self. That means, if I'm rich towards self, well, it's the example we've seen already, isn't it? I make much of myself. I think highly of myself. I arrange my life with myself as the primary target, the goal. But if I'm rich toward God, well, that means that I make much of him. I think highly of him. I arrange my life and the things entrusted to me, including my wallet, I arrange them all with God as my priority. And so for every one of us, again, whether we've discovered oil or not, that will have direct implications. And it's worth really thinking about that. It's a wonderful sort of personal challenge. If I'm rich toward God, then I will be poor toward self. And it's got to impact everything. And so it'd be worth thinking about how you use your various sort of list of skills and resources that have been entrusted to you, your time and your various different parts of education, where you've climbed to in your career, the ambitions that you have for your retirement, perhaps in your retirement, your family, your cash used for him, not for me. You see, we can't take things with us. We really cannot take money and possessions with us. But wonderfully, as we start to grasp this, we'll see that we can send them on ahead. I love this story. Again, I'm sure I will have shared it with some of you at a different time. Two men, good friends, both worked together, highly lucrative business they were involved in. And during their time in the city, one of them left his job because he'd become a Christian. And he decided that the best thing for him to do in his situation was put his career to one side and instead go off and become a missionary. These two, they remain good friends. And the one who wasn't converted climbed higher and higher up the career ladder and became one of the sort of super rich that we often hear about. As time went on, they both became unwell. They both went into hospital. And the daughter of the missionary went to visit her father's old friend in what turned out to be his last days. And he said this to her. He said, "You may wonder why I cannot be as happy and content as your father, but just think of the difference between us. He is going to his treasure, and I must leave all of mine behind." To be rich toward God. I mean, that would really be, that'd be something really valuable to think about, wouldn't it? That's the primary application. You have to sort of work out what that means for you. Here are a few points to mull on. One, don't get heart and soul confused. We need to think about the relative value of our soul compared to our body. Don't get our sort of body and soul confused. Let me try to illustrate this. This is a real ring. In this box is a ring that my grandmother's engagement ring. It's really beautiful. It's got all sorts of stones, which I won't try and name, but you can sort of see how they glisten. I went into Hatton Garden and asked various people, and they told me it was worth a lot of money. Now, just imagine, I should make it clear, it's no longer my ring. I gave it to my wife, obviously, but I thought, I'd borrow it today for the illustration. just imagine, okay, this box, I reckon, is probably worth about 27p. The ring is worth a number of thousand, okay? Now, imagine being given something like this and getting really excited about the box. What a beautiful box. How amazing. I'm going to treasure that box. I'm going to look after that box. I'm going to work that box beautifully. You can see the point, can't you? We need to get body and soul the right way around. Secondly, you don't have as long as you want. Look at verse 20. I mean, verse 20 is there. It really should alarm us. Verse 20, God said to him, "Fool, this night your soul is required of you." This night. Three, what would sending treasure on ahead actually look like for you? That book that Jeremy mentioned, that would be a good place to sort of start, the Gospel Patrons book. That's, lots of people have found that really, really useful. And just to be clear, you don't need to have much, if any, money to be able to really think about being rich toward God. There's a few other books on the back you may find useful. There's another one called The Money Mentor that Jeremy's mentioned many times in the past as well. That's quite good. Think seriously about these things. There's a great illustration that came to mind from Schindler's List. I was asking some of the youngsters if they'd seen it. I sort of assumed nobody had watched it. And they all the people that had graduated in the last few years, all said, yeah, love it. Dad's favorite film, that sort of thing. So maybe, I sort of assume you guys have seen it as well, Schindler's List. And at the end of the film, the war is over, and Mr. Schindler is sort of looking back on his achievements and looking at all the Jewish people he's managed to save. He's sort of giving them various jobs in the sort of post-war life. He spent, of course, his entire personal fortune. He was super rich, and he spent almost his entire personal fortune to bribe German officials in order to save these people from the death chambers. But as he looks at them, he breaks down. It's a really moving sort of moment at the end of the film. And he says, "I could have done more." People around him try to console him. And then he points to his nice car. He's got a sort of Rolls Royce or something outside. And he says, "I could have sold it and I could have saved a few more." He pulls out an expensive fountain pen and a watch. And he says, "These could have bought another life." And he breaks down. It's worth thinking about seriously, isn't it? I mean, what are we going to do with what's entrusted to us? As we think about what's valuable, being rich toward God must mean prioritizing my soul over my body. It must mean I'm more concerned for the souls around me than the material. So as we close, let's just remind each other where we are in Luke's gospel. I think we say this every time we hit Luke's gospel at this stage in the narrative. Jesus is intentionally going to Jerusalem to die. He knows he's going to die. It's not coming as a surprise. And of course, it's as we get to know Jesus that we'll find all of the motivation that we need to think about what it means to be rich toward him, toward God himself. Because of course, it's Jesus who was prepared to give everything, even his body, for the sake of our souls. Why don't I pray?